You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to Community Connections, and being the second Wednesday of the month, I've got to get make sure I'm in the right week. We've got Con from Hutchison Legal. So first of all, welcome, Con.
G'day, Alan. Good to be back. Sorry about last time.
Well, these things happen. Now, we've had a couple of inquiries over a little while, and we asked you to go away and do a bit of work on this. We have the Magistrates Court, we've got the County Court, we've got a number of courts, and a number of people are a bit confused, or they've been asking me as to what the different courts can do and why do we have so many courts.
Right, okay. Would you like me to start with the highest or the lowest?
Start with the lowest.
Okay, yep. Well, there's a bit of a competition for the lowest. if it's called the Magistrates Court of Victoria, it's a court. It deals with a lot. Most legal matters are dealt with in terms of numbers.
Right.
It deals with summary criminal offences, which is your lower level criminal offences. So most of the crime is there. They're called summary offences, like a traffic offence, minor assaults, property damage.
Yep.
They also handle civil disputes.
When you say traffic offences, a lot of those now are on the spot, aren't they?
Oh, well, you have your fines, but if you want to go challenge them, you end up going through there.
Yep.
If you want to question the radar gun or whatever cameras, the newfangled cameras they have now, that take your photo in both directions, so they're at the back of the car.
Gotcha,
but it doesn't matter which way you're travelling, it can take your photo if you're speeding. So, yeah, watch out for that. So Magistrates Court deals with all of that, all of the minor criminal offences.
Can a magistrate send you to jail?
Depends. I'm not a criminal lawyer.
Right.
I think they can, but it's pretty rare, I would have thought. It's usually something...
Low key.
Yeah, it's usually stuff that's going to be dealt with a fine, with a community corrections order, some alternatives. The idea is not to fill the prisons.
Yep.
And if the magistrates were putting people in jail, there wouldn't be enough prisons, that's for sure. So, yeah, normally, and something like that, I think you're going to end up in a higher court. If you'd want your matter moved to a higher court if, because it is possible for matters to move between the courts in certain circumstances. But So Magistrates Court handles most of those things, and civil matters and disputes, civil disputes up to $100,000.
Fencing disputes and all that
stuff.
Yeah,
fencing disputes. Yep. There's even like, you can, there's even industrial claims, small claims.
Yeah. What about wills? Would you claim it?
Not in the magistrates' court. Yep. No. So you usually though it's debts. You're suing for debts. You've supplied goods on credit. They haven't paid. You're suing them for that. That's for less than $100,000. You're doing that in the magistrates' court.
Yep.
So this is where most cases go, there can be some what's called less serious indictable offences. Indictable is a word which means the serious criminal offences.
Yep.
But you can consent, you can agree to have that heard in the magistrates' court. And they're usually because you want it dealt with quicker.
And the penalties would be smaller, would they?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But again, I'm not a criminal lawyer, so ask for a criminal lawyer's advice exactly if you're in that situation. So magistrates' court is there. It's your everyday court. To deal with most matters that people would come across.
Yep.
And a lot of their time is taken up with intervention orders, family safety, it's called personal safety intervention order, PSIO, or family violence intervention order. So a lot of their time is taken up with that, dealing with people seeking orders to protect themselves from someone that's acting in a unsafe manner.
Yep.
There is VCAT, the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal.
Yeah.
It also deals with a range of matters, and not all of some of them are at the lower end.
But they're not offences, though, are they, against a person or anything like that?
No, that's not. It's not criminal in there.
Yep.
They deal with many disputes like residential tenancies disputes between the landlord and tenant, although these days it's called the rental provider and the and the what's the tenant called? The renter, I think. They changed the words landlord and tenant. They don't like those old words, so they've changed it. So they have residential tenancies. They do deal with planning disputes, of course. So when you want to argue about your neighbour's new development, you can end up in VCAT to dispute that. So it has like specialist lists rather than covering everything. It covers specific types of matters in separate lists. So you can have a civil claim as well in VCAT. So you've got a choice for a civil claim. Do you want to go to magistrates court or do you want to go to VCAT? Now, the difference is usually under $10,000 claim, you can't take a lawyer with you to VCAT for a civil claim. So if you're confident to represent yourself for a claim less than $10,000, you'd be representing yourself. The other side can't get a lawyer unless the VCAT member allows it, which they're encouraged not to allow it for small claims. And, going to the magistrates' court, you might be suing for $10,000 or less, but you're going to spend $20,000 through that. The difference, though, is getting costs back. If you win, if you're representing yourself in VCAT, you don't get costs against the other side, generally speaking. You can apply, but you're not going to get it generally. In a magistrates' court, if you win, you're supposed to get some costs back. But those costs are limited under certain scales of the court. And it's quite that's a whole topic on its own, the magistrates' court scales of what scale applies in what circumstances, because it depends if you've made some settlement offer before the case, during the case, before the trial. You can get different amounts of costs back depending on if the other side were being unreasonable or not in rejecting your offers to settle. So I would say cases sort of 20,000 and above, you probably want to go to Maggie's court. Under 20,000, you're probably going to go to VCAT. Under 10,000, probably definitely want to go to VCAT. But they have different timelines as well, different procedures, different processes to deal with a dispute. VCAT also has specialist lists like guardianship. So if you're having a dispute who should a guardian be appointed? So sometimes a social worker will be concerned about an elder person and can apply to VCAT to say, hey, this person needs some kind of guardian appointed. Sometimes there's a fight between family members as who's the appropriate person to be appointed as guardian, So VCAT deals with those kind of disputes. Over guardianship or appointing an administrator to deal with a person's legal and financial affairs. So there's a difference. Guardianship is sort of choosing where that person lives. Administrator means legal and financial control for that person. So there's so that's why it's called guardianship and administration. There's an act for that. So VCAT deals with those things. And VCAT deals with discrimination type cases under Victorian discrimination laws. But it cannot deal with anything that's a federal matter. So the federal court system, the federal laws, VCAT's not allowed to touch. And a few years ago there were some VCAT decisions which meant that sometimes your case would be partly covered by VCAT and partly covered via federal laws. As soon as there's a federal law involved, off you go, off to the county court. You don't you skip the Maggie's court and you go to the county court. Because there's a federal matter being argued about in what would normally in the what was commonly accepted as a VCAT case. Became you can't run that here. So if you say you've got a small claim, a civil claim, but you say there was a misleading and deceptive conduct by the seller. Well, that's under federal law, the misleading. There's state law that talks about misleading and deceptive conduct, but there's also federal law. As soon as you refer to the federal law, off you go. You're out of VCAT. So
I've got to take a quick break. Then we want to come back and find out about the county court.
We'll go higher than...
How we go. No worries.
This is Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley.
Angus, this is your request.
Listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Hope you enjoyed that song, Angus. It was Britney Spears. Right, so we've gone to magistrates, we're up to the...
I wanted to mention one more thing on VCAT. Yep. A substantial area of VCAT is building disputes.
Yep.
And so many people have had sad stories going through VCAT with building disputes, trying to get their builder to fix things and
yep.
replace things and pay money. But like I said, if you can throw in a federal law type claim, you can get that moved to the county court, which is where we're going next. Yep. So county court, it's in between the magistrates court and the Supreme Court. It sits yep. in the middle. It hears serious criminal matters.
We talk murder or not that high?
Usually they are off in the Supreme Court, the murder right. cases.
Yep.
But serious offences, like assaults, you know, like grievous body harm type claims yep. or cases, sorry, I should say, those kind of serious criminal matters.
Yep.
And civil claims above 100,000. So magistrates courts under 100, county court is above 100. Most serious criminal cases go there. Larger and more complex civil disputes. Oh, sorry, I should say civil claims over 100, sorry, go to county court. A lot of matters get through the county court as well because they also have sort of some dedicated lists of cases where judges are familiar with the type of matter that's coming before it.
Can I just ask?
And it also has building cases as well there.
If you want to challenge an outcome,
mm-hmm.
if it was in the magistrates' court,
mm-hmm.
do you challenge it in the magistrates' court or do you have to go up to the county court and the county court to the Supreme Court if it's there? Do you
no, the appeals go to Supreme Court.
All appeals. Yep. Sorry, go on. Well, now we're coming up to the Supreme Court.
So appeals of cases go to the Supreme Court. Also, appeals of VCAT decisions go off to the Supreme Court.
Oh,
as
they
well.
Don't go to the county court?
No.
Yep.
No.
Yep.
So I hope that my recollection is correct. I hope someone doesn't go, oh, you're wrong, Con. Anyway, that's my recollection is, yeah, all the appeals go off to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
and it's the appeals court. But it also, the Supreme Court also hears cases at what's called at first instance. But, yeah, so you've got your county court.
What do you mean that first instance?
First instance means the first time that it goes to the trial before the judge.
Yep.
So that's called at first instance, and then you have on appeal.
Yep.
So the Supreme Court can hear a case.
Yep.
So it's the highest court in the state. It has a trial division, which is hearing cases at first instance, and it has the Court of Appeal. So you'll get a judge or three judges in the Court of Appeal, depending on where the appeal's coming from.
You don't have a jury in an appeal like that, do you?
Some cases have juries, but not many. So they're the most serious criminal cases may have a jury. There's some cases where you elect whether you want a jury or not.
Yeah.
And some cases have to have the jury in the Supreme Court.
Right.
So we've got the Supreme Court now hearing the most serious criminal cases, such as murder, the biggest or most complex civil disputes. So the corporate cases, the big companies fighting each other. And the Supreme Court, as I said, has appeals, hears appeals from the county court, and sometimes its own decisions go to the appeal court of the Supreme Court. So just some of these things overlap, though, especially between county and Supreme. And some courts have what's called concurrent jurisdiction, which means both courts can hear the same type of matter. So civil disputes can go in all three courts, depending on the amount and the complexity. And criminal cases, depending on what they are, can be heard in different courts. But the exclusive jurisdiction, as we say, Supreme Court has exclusive jurisdiction for the most serious criminal matters and appeals, and VCAT can't hear federal matters at all. So, they're your different types of cases and courts, and your legal bills just go up and up. As you go up the court hierarchy.
Con, I've got to ask, and this might not be fair to ask you off the cuff, but can a judge who's in the county court sit in the Supreme Court, or are they do they have various qualifications? Like the county court, the judge has got a certain qualification, but Supreme Courts have
more? They're normally appointed just to the court that they're appointed to.
Yeah.
There is, though, with VCAT does have some of the county court judges will sit as members of VCAT.
Oh, do they?
Yes. Yeah. So there's some crossover there between county court and VCAT, but generally speaking, no, if you're appointed a Supreme Court judge, you're just the Supreme Court.
Yep.
And the same magistrate, you're just a magistrate court, and county court, you're there unless you're sitting as a VCAT member. So that's how that works.
I want to talk to you about something else, but we're going to take a quick break.
Sure.
And we're going to come back with more.
Oh, I could hide neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings. The 6 o'clock alarm would never ring, but it rings and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold and it stings.
Cheer up,
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Con, just before we move on, because we've got another subject that we've promised somebody we'd get an answer to, but you've mentioned in passing community correction orders.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so someone goes to court, they get a community correction order, would it be, and who follows that up?
Well, you're testing me out there. I'm not exactly sure. There's meant to be like social workers that are meant to follow up and make sure they're complying with their whatever the obligation that they're given. So,
and this is probably then unfair, does the court actually at some stage go back and say to Fred Nurk or whoever, I put this person on a correction order, what's happened? Or does it then just go out of the courts into the other and it's not followed up?
My understanding is there is a reporting back on that, but I'd have to ask my friendly criminal lawyer friend exactly how that works. I don't know. I'm not familiar with, but I do believe it. There's a reporting back of that, because if you're not complying, then, you know, it's sort of like there's a worse punishment for you if you don't follow this order. So follow this order, serve your time, do something helpful for the community. Otherwise, you'll be back here if I find out you haven't done it.
Yep.
You'll be back here for a different punishment.
Right. Now, the other thing, we had a question a couple of months ago about medical care. Not only medical care for prisoners, but somebody was in the prison system and they elected to have something done and the taxpayer paid. And I know we had at least one person ring up very irate as to why we should be doing that. What responsibilities do we have? I understand if somebody's sick or they've got cancer or they need a heart operation or something, but is there an actual perimeter that says this is all the taxpayer has to pay?
Yep. So with thanks to the Fitzroy Legal Service that provides a lot of information for free online, there is a website called the Prison Law Handbook. So if you want to look that up and know the rights of prisoners, that's also where you'll find the these particular healthcare rights of a prisoner. And according to its Section 47 of the Corrections Act, Victoria, that's the core statutory section where it talks about prisoner rights, and that includes healthcare rights. So in Victoria, prisoners are owed a duty by the state to provide reasonable medical care and treatment for the preservation of health.
Yeah.
And that care should be delivered at community standards. So it's not better than what you get if you're in your suburbs for healthcare, but it should be at least what you'd get if you were out in the suburbs looking for medical care.
Yep.
So they have a right to access a private practitioner at their own expense if they can get approval for that. And so therefore they're entitled to get the same sort of care they would get if they were out in the community. It has to be provided without discrimination. They should be seen as soon as possible after entering custody, and they have the right to also get to a dentist, a physiotherapist or a chiropractor. If they need mental health care, they've got the right to try and get some specialist care as well. But there are medical officers in the prisons. They assess the needs. And they've also got a right to get reasonable dental treatment to preserve their dental health. So, and these rights also sort of have under the umbrella of the Victorian Charter of Human Rights. So you've got to be, you've got the right to life in prison. You've got the right to humane treatment whilst you're in detention, and you can't be, you have to be protected from cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. So essentially, all of that comes down to a prisoner should be able to get the same healthcare that a private citizen in the community can get. Not to a higher standard, not to a lower standard, just to the same community standard.
And you said that they could have access if they could pay for it, but a lot of the stuff wouldn't be would be paid for by the...
The state generally the state, is it? Paying for the healthcare,
yeah.
But at that standard, if the prisoner can afford more specialist care, they can seek approval to engage that specialist care.
All right. We're going to take a break. I'm going to give Con the next question. I hope he's got a pen, which is not looking good. And then we'll come back and we want to talk about trusts because they've altered some of that in the last budget.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Con, we've had a couple of questions, and, and I'm sure the first one's not going to surprise you. We've actually had two or three people want to know if you could have a quick look what sort of figures there are with bail, because people are saying... And I don't want to get political on this show. It's not political. But some of the people in the politics are saying that, oh, yeah, we're locking up a lot more people. And yet people are saying, look, more and more people are not getting are still getting bail. Some of them are out on 20 and 30, lots of bail. Could you see if there's any figures available to prove either way?
Okay.
I don't want to get into the politics of it. We just want to know that there should be some figures saying, oh, yes, we are locking up more or we're not. Now, the other thing is too, and this is probably a bit more of a serious thing, and I know you're not a criminal lawyer, but hopefully you'll be able to find it. And I don't want to criticise the courts, and you and I don't, because neither of us want to go to court, wind up in jail over it. So we're not criticising at all. But there was a case a couple of weeks ago. Now, maybe I'll keep out of that case. But anyway, some of these young people are getting off just on their age. So at what age, is there an age where it's deemed that you just can't understand? Surely where people are able to look up what sentences might be and that they understand. Is there an age where you just can't be charged on anything? I know they were going to change it and bring it up.
Yep.
But like, can you charge an 8, 9, 10 or a 10, 12-year-old?
Okay. I thought we looked at this before, but I'll look at it again.
Yeah, but we've had a case come up since
then.
Yeah,
and we've had new slogans like, what is it, adult time for violent crime.
Adult time for adult crime?
Oh, no, that's the Queensland one. Victorian one is adult time for violent crime.
The other thing is we had a case, and I don't want to touch it, the other day where somebody got off and just said, and yet... I don't want to say any more.
Was it mental health incapacity? Purely on age?
It was just purely on age.
Okay. So, yeah, because there is the age where you can be criminally responsible or you can't be held criminally responsible.
Well, we just want to know at where that stands.
Mm.
Because, anyway, so we'll do that.
Okay.
Now, they changed the
The federal budget has got a lot of debate and talk going, a lot of tongues wagging.
Is it what?
And one aspect of that that I would want to say to the listeners, which I found strange or a bit fascinating, this idea that they're now in a couple of years' time they're going to tax family discretionary trusts.
Yep.
At a 30% flat tax rate. So if that trust earned $100,000 of income, it would pay $30,000 tax first before being able to distribute it to the beneficiaries.
Yep.
Now, a lot of people for decades now have been advised by their accountants and their lawyers to use these family trusts.
Yep.
Because it's a way of splitting the income so that you pay essentially across that total amount of income, you pay less tax because if you've got an 18-year-old child, you can give them, you'd probably give them $40,000. But look, I'm not a tax lawyer. I'm not a tax advisor. So don't take any of this as tax advice. But but you could distribute income in a way that you'd pay less tax overall.
And so the
government's trying to change that.
Yeah. Is it also whereby you might be a high-flying footballer or somewhere where you get a whole lot of money, $1 million a year for 3 years and then nothing after that?
Well, that's right. They'd want to be using trusts as well if they can. But the difference is this. A wage and salary earner, if they earned $135,000, they would pay roughly $31,000 tax.
Yep.
And they're paying 30 cents in the dollar, but only on the dollars above 45,000. So the first 45,000 has less tax.
Yep.
The next 90,000 has the 30 cents on it.
Yep.
But if the trust earns $135,000, it's going to pay under these new laws $40,000 or $40,500. So you wouldn't want to earn that income in your trust. You'd want to earn, and that's the point of it. So in the next 2 to 3 years, there's going to be a mad scramble. Everyone who's set up in these trust structures, and it's a lot of small businesses, a lot of different types of, you know, it's not the big end of town.
Yeah.
There's so many small businesses that have a discretionary trust, family trusts, that are now going to be forced to restructure. So there's going to be a huge scramble over the next couple of years. Because who wants to pay an extra $10,000 in tax?
Why should you?
If you're going to earn it in that structure through a trust, why not earn it through a company and pay 25% tax before it's distributed to shareholders as dividends, right? So it's going to change.
The accountants will be busy.
The accountants, the tax lawyers, they're going to be flat out for the next 2 years because of this. And we don't have a federal election to challenge it until, May 2028. Yeah. I don't think it's until then, the next federal election. So this is the thing. It's going to change a lot of behaviour. It's going to change a lot of what's been established for decades. And I just think anyone who knows anything that they're connected to or related to a family discretionary trust... Yep. Got to go get advice from a tax lawyer, from an accountant that knows what they're doing, definitely don't sit on your hands and wait because you'll suffer all sorts of consequences you didn't expect. And I've got to say, I do also find it strange. And again, I wouldn't care who brought this up, which side of politics, doesn't matter. But the narrative around the wealth that's been built up by those people are using these methods and structures.
Yep.
Well, we'll help the younger people by telling them you'll never be allowed to use those structures ever in your life. It doesn't make sense to me.
That makes sense.
Because wait a minute, these structures worked to build up family wealth.
Yeah.
But you're telling the young people, sorry, you won't be allowed to benefit from those structures because we're getting rid of it. We're putting this big disincentive in place so you can't use it. And I just find that very strange, you know.
Not a good one.
So come on.
Yeah, and we've got to take a quick break and we're going to be back with more.
I'm Sandra from Yarra Junction Library, and you're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Con, in the few minutes we've got left, we're fast running out of time, you want to tell us a bit about some change to the retirement villages.
Yes, from the 1st of May this year, retirement village laws that were overhauled last year, it's come into effect. And there's some major changes. to the retirement villages. So if you know anyone that's thinking about going into them or already there.
I was going to say, does it, have they altered retrospect for the people that are in there as well?
Yeah, so there's going to be new things that have to be done by the operators of the retirement villages.
Yep.
So one of the major changes is bringing in standardised plain English contracts because... Yep. In the past, I mean, I've seen these contracts. They're super thick, more than an inch.
Like, cover everything.
Yeah, that's right. They blame the lawyers for that. They always want to cover every possible circumstance. Yep. But I suppose it makes sense because, like, a contract of sale of land is a standardised contract with some special conditions varying it.
Yep.
So they're trying to bring that in. That'll come in by September. People have to transition to these standardised, by September, transition to these standardised contracts so that there's clearer pre-contract information and clear information about your entry and exit costs. Yeah. Because, of course, these retirement villages are, it's a lifestyle, it's not an investment.
No.
So, you know, you're paying for something, you're paying for benefits that they offer you for your lifestyle. It's not an investment where you're going to make money, if I can put it that way.
Yep.
There's rules, there's a 7-day cooling off period and condition reports before moving in. So you've got to make sure, so it's sort of like renting.
Yep.
You've got to get a condition report before moving in. There's annual contract checks that they're bringing in so you can review your financial position each year. And there's a stronger dispute resolution process, including a free complaints and conciliation service. I'm not sure where you get that. And expanded, and it says expanded VCAT powers for serious disputes. We talked about VCAT before.
Yeah.
I don't know how VCAT's going to have time for a new area to deal with. I hope they get the funding to be able to look after it. So people in retirement villages, of course, they'll have to have the emergency management plans and they'll have to run annual evacuation exercises. So, you
that'll
know,
be great in some of them.
That's right. So it's no good having a plan, but you never practice it.
Yeah.
And the people who've moved in haven't done it before and don't know where to go if there was an emergency. So, you know, I mean, these are the sorts of things. If you work in an office, you would have regular evacuation drills.
Sure.
But for retirement villages, they're making it mandatory. You can the homes aren't allowed to unreasonably block pets. Now everyone loves a pet, almost everyone loves a pet, I think. So they've tried to bring it sort of swing it back in favour of the.
Con, is there any? Because I know of someone that has got a rented property. And the woman's brought in a great big bulldog. Mm. I would have thought that it had to have some relation to the size. Is that not right?
Oh, I'm not exactly sure about that. Sorry, Alan, I can't answer that off the top of my head. But I know that both for residential tenancies and now for retirement villages, that they're making it easier for the residents to have pets.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's okay if it's a little dog and a little cat. But when you start talking big dogs.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, where is the fenced off area to protect everyone else from the dog if it's you got to make
sure. This place got none.
Yeah, so I'm not sure how can be allowed. And again, there'll probably be a dispute between the residents whether they want to allow that kind of pet or not.
Yeah.
So they're the major changes there in retirement villages. All I'd suggest is that if you are contemplating going into a retirement village or you're already there, you should get some advice on these changes that have come in.
Yeah.
So because they are more skewed towards the residents. So, but definitely those contracts get a proper advice on residential village contracts.
Yeah, there does seem to be. And I've not in one, and so I don't know about it. But quite a few people seem to get a shock at the bill when they go to move out, don't they?
Yeah, well, and that's the point, to make it more obvious as to, so you know what you're signing up to. I mean, I've heard good stories. I've heard people that absolutely love their life in a retirement village.
And they love it.
And they're having a great time.
Yep.
And then they feel young again because there's older people there than them. They've moved in and they're all suddenly the young people there.
Yep.
But anyway, that's just a personal observation.
I know some that, and it's really rejuvenated their life. And they said Well, we don't care what it costs to go out because that's the kids' problem. We're not going to be here to worry about
it. Well, that's the thing, right? Like I said, it's not an investment. And if you're the kids of somebody that's gone into retirement village, your inheritance is less. I can tell you
it's
that
not
for sure.
As good as you thought.
You are getting less than you would have got if they stayed home.
Yeah. Con, thanks for coming in again. It's always great to have you in. And we'll get you to have a look at the bail and see that how we're going and also what sort of level of culpability for different crimes. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if whether it's just a blanket ban at a certain age or whether at one age you can be held responsible to this level and another level. So be great. We've had that. We've had more than a couple of quotes. Bail is always going to cost be something that people want to know about because it just anyway. We all have our views when we're here.
That's it. Great to be here again. Thanks, Alan.